What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, listeners. Thank you so much for tuning in. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Ken Kelly. Ken Kelly is best known for producing and engineering the Fleetwood Mac albums Rumors, Tusk, Mirage, Live, and the Chainbox set, along with his daughter Colby Kelly's albums Coco, Breakthrough, All of You, and Christmas in the Sand. Ken's recordings have sold over 50 million copies. His record production and engineering efforts have earned him numerous Grammy nominations, including an Album of the Year Grammy and Best Engineered Album. To find out more about him and what he's doing, you can go to his website, www.artistmax.org. And now I give you Ken Kelly. Okay, I'm here with Ken Kelly. Ken, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Joshua. Is it Joshua or Josh?
Oh, Josh, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Perfect. Thank you. I appreciate that. So I'm really excited to talk with you, Ken. I want to track through certainly, you know, music history as it relates to you, to your career. Before we get there, Ken, please tell our listeners briefly who you are and what you do.
Sure. My name is Ken Kelly, and I'm a record producer. I've been a record producer since 1975. How long is that?
Some time.
So that's about 45 years. So it's getting old hat, but some of the acts I produced is Fleetwood Mac Rumors, Fleetwood Mac Tusk, Fleetwood Mac Mirage album, and the Live album, and also my daughter, Colby Kelly. And we did four albums with her, I think, and I've been a pretty lucky guy, being in the right place at the right time, and that I didn't choke it, and when I got into that situation.
Yeah, excellent, Ken. Thank you. So winding the clock back then, Ken, how was it that you broke into the music business? What was your start?
I was a musician. I was actually going to college to be a lawyer is what I thought I wanted to be. At least that's what my parents wanted me to be. And I decided that I would get a part-time job in a law office going through college and see what it's really like. And I decided I hated it. It was definitely not for me. So I bailed out of that. I grew up in San Jose. So music came through. I got turned on to music and I started playing it. And it made me feel good. And I realized that that's what I wanted to do with my life is make people feel good and feel good when I'm making music. So I started, bought a guitar, learned to play it, started writing songs. I bought a couple tape recorders and I learned to record myself and some people I was working with. And that love for recording carried over. I moved from San Jose to Los Angeles to get a job. Then my girlfriend moved up there. And so I followed her to LA and I got a job in a recording studio and it was one of the best studios. I had never heard of it, Wally Heider's studios. And what they did a lot was they did the live recording. So I started recording all the top bands, of course, record live albums. So I got to experience it to every one of these bands. And eventually I was there 5 years and Fleetwood Mac came along and they said they liked my stuff. I was a young hotshot engineer. I can say it, you know, modestly now, but, you know, I was out to kill and I loved making everything sound as good as it could be. I remember my Wally Heider gave me a job to record a polka, right? And so I recorded this polka and the drums are right there in your face and the accordion's just sizzling off to the right. I left hard left and hard right mixing. And so everybody's going, okay, well, it's kind of weird for polka music, but it sounds good. And eventually Fleetwood Mac came along and they said, well, hey, we want you to go record this new album we're working on. They didn't know it would eventually became Rumors. And so they took me up to Sausalito away from my Wally Heider studios. And I recorded the Rumors for a year and took my little dog with me. And I wrote a book about it. It's called Making Rumors. I probably should have it right here somewhere anyway. But it was a fun ride working with these bands. I loved how you lock yourself into a room when you're in a recording studio and you're like one big family. And so that was about 12 months of that working with Fleetwood Mac and shortly after I started working with them, I realized that they were all breaking up and they're yelling at each other. And so maybe I should let you answer more questions.
No, that's no problem, Ken. I love the enthusiasm. That's why I didn't jump in. And I certainly have some questions later on to discuss rumors. I wouldn't dare have you on and not ask the questions, right? I would love to know, what would you say is the, what should we call it, day-to-day responsibility of a music producer?
Well, I suppose it'd be like being a teacher. You know, you have to keep the kids in line. You have to keep them busy. You have to be efficient with your time. And I found, for me, it was being kind of a timekeeper. You know, you would come into the band would want to kick back and play games or whatever, and you had to keep them focused on what the task at hand was. I had to keep them on schedule. I came in and the list started noon and worked to midnight. And it was hard for me to get them to stop at midnight when they had an artificial stimulus that keeping them wanting to record. But I found shortly thereafter, when I let them record, we worked till 3 or 4 in the morning, and then nobody wanted to show up at noon. So then we started showing up at 3 and 4 in the afternoon, and we started going later and later, and the whole schedule got screwed up. So basically, when I was hired by Fleetwood Mac, I was hired to be an engineer, and I just loved instruments. I loved getting great sound on guitars, great sound on keyboards, anything. Just, I mean, these speakers were mine to have my way with, and the instruments were great. And I remember one of the first days, Christine McBee said, "Which take did you like better? My performance, that take, or the one just before it?" I said, "I don't know. I was listening to cymbals." She goes, I said, "Why don't you come in and listen? I can play it back for you." She goes, "No, I'm not coming in. We're all situated out here with our instruments. We have our headphones on. I have my drink. I have my cigarettes going. I don't want to come in." She says, "You're sitting there between the speakers. I want you to start paying attention to what we're all doing, because we're all listening to ourselves play, and you need to see if any of us are stepping on each other's toes, and whether the take was too fast or too slow, and if I'm in the wrong key, or I'm playing not in the wrong key, but in the wrong register, and you're not hearing my instrument because I'm clashing with somebody else." She goes, "I want you to pay attention to all those things." And I said, "Okay, I can do that too," and wrote it down. And so that basically they were telling me what they wanted. They wanted me to be their ears in between the speakers, so they didn't have to come in. They wanted me to say, "Hey, Chris, that was a great take. You did a little riff in the middle of the song. Could you do more of that riffing?" "Yeah, Ken, that's a great idea. I'm glad you caught that." And that's what happened, just being there and being present. So she was encouraging me. So in plain English, they taught me to be a producer and paid me to do it. While there's so many other guys who were jealous of me getting the gig. But their previous producer had a big fight with them and sued them. And I think the fact that they had to force me into being a producer, I wasn't being too pushy, and it was just a nice symbiotic relationship.
Interesting. Thank you. Want to make sure that I read this right. Is it true that you worked with Frank Sinatra?
Well, I worked on some Frank Sinatra music. I didn't work with him.
Okay. Yeah. What were the circumstances of that like? I'm just curious.
Well, I built a studio, and we were doing music mixing, and we started doing 5.1 mixing, which was surround sound mixing. And Capitol Records called us up and they said, "We have a bunch of old masters we'd like you to convert into spatial audio." So they had Frank Sinatra, Nat King Cole, Bing Crosby, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr. So they sent us these two-track, three-track, multi-track masters, and we'd have to figure out how to spread it out into, so the vocal was in the center and the stereo was on either side. So we basically processed it into surround sound.
I'd love to know, what was it like working with Warren Zevon?
He was great. He was a really cool guy. He was kind of in a hurry. Seems like we started that session late at night. So he came in at 10 o'clock at night, and I'm already thinking, let's rock and roll here. Let's get this thing over with before too many drugs get into the session. But he was great. So he came in and he had his musicians all knew what they wanted to do, that we set up at the mic. So we just recorded and we kind of got the take right away. I said he was prepared. And that was easy. Fleetwood Mac, they didn't know what they had done. They just were writing these songs on the fly. So it was a completely different experience. for me to work with one who already had the song and just wanted to get it recorded.
Right, right. So was it when you were working with Warren Zevon, was that when you first met Lindsey Buckingham?
No, I met Lindsey long before.
Huh.
Maybe not long before, but probably a couple of years before. So I met Lindsey when I was working at Wally Hyder's. Wally Hyder had a recording truck. And which, as I said, Wally Hyder's was famous for doing live recordings. And Fleetwood Mac had just released their Fleetwood Mac album. And they did a tour to support the record. And they did a show called King Biscuit Flower Hour in 1975. And Wally recorded them. Wally's truck recorded them. And Wally also said, listen, I'll give you a discount if you come back and mix it at my studio. So I got a call. Wally had landed Fleetwood Mac to do the mix down, and they wanted me to do it. I didn't know who Fleetwood Mac was. So they came into the studio. My friend said, buy the last album, and it had a picture of every one of the band members, but the names were mixed up. So under Stevie's name was Lindsey, and it looked like it was in order. So Stevie walked in, and I reached out, and I said, Lindsey, big fan. But then Lindsey walked in the door, and with Richard Dashett, his good friend, and I were co-engineering. And I think we said, hey, Lindsey, you want to smoke a joint? And that was the seal of the deal.
That's funny. Yeah, I know, Ken, we've kind of already scaled the ground a little bit, but just to kind of clarify it for our audience. So yeah, it was 1977. There was the album Rumors that came out, which you produced, obviously, which was a massive hit. And just to make it kind of broad, I'd love to know, what was the experience producing that album like, besides kind of what we've already covered?
Well, it's fantastic. I mean, the Fleetwood Mac took a long time. When we started doing the Rumors album, their White album was just climbing the charts. They had released, I think, Over My Head just was released. And so when I did that King Biscuit Flower Hour, they also said to me, listen, we love you. You get our music. We love working with you. But they said, unfortunately, we have to mix the single version of the second single off the Fleetwood Mac album, which was called Rihanna. So, I said, well, we wish you could do it, but we've already booked this guy over a record plant to mix the Rihanna and single. Back then, you had to do a separate mix for the single mix because it was mono specific. And so I said, okay, well, I guess easy come, easy go. And they left me and they went over to a record plant to record, remix the single of Rihanna. And that was on a Sunday. And they called me Sunday night. And I said, it went horribly wrong. It didn't work. So they called me and said, can we book a time with you? They'd do it on Monday. So they came in, and I had already done a live mix of Rihanna. And so I said, sure. So I wasn't nervous at all with this poor guy that went over there to do it at the record plant. He was a nervous wreck. And Lindsey's and is hovering over him. What are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? He was like, I don't know. So they came back to me, and it was like, hi, guys. Yeah, we can do that again. And there was no pressure on me whatsoever. So we did a smoke and mix of Rihanna. And then, so cut back to now, we're starting the Rumors album, and my version of Rihanna is now playing on the radio, and Rihanna's just going crazy, and that whole album is going on the charts. It's just climbing. I think their album was still climbing the charts 8 months later when we were still working on Rumors. So in English, that is, the label was like going, they're sitting back smoking cigars, and they're going, whatever Calais and the band wanted to spend on, we don't care. Because their album's still climbing. So it was like they wouldn't interfere with us at all. So for me, it was like, normally you have a record company coming in, like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Have you thought about this part and that part? Have you used to this musician? But they were just like, go do what you got to do. So for me, it was a great opportunity. We just kept making the record. And we did 12 songs in 12 months.
Wow.
So where we just spent our time and we made, what felt like a great record. And I think a lesson to be learned is that I don't think anybody's smart enough to make a record that sells 44 million in 3 weeks. Stevie told me a couple years ago, she said, I went in to do my latest record and the record company gave me 3 weeks in the studio. And we had 52 weeks.
Wow.
And I mean, we could have taken longer, but so, I think get it right, take your time and feel the music.
Feel the music. I like that, Ken. One of my favorite songs is Don't Stop. Yeah, I loved when they performed it live with the USC Trojan Marching Band. I listen to that, I'm not making a joke, I think probably once a day. It's part of my workout mix. And I'd love to know what producing that particular song was like. Were there any memories that strike you?
For Don't Stop?
Yes, sir.
I know you said Don't Stop, but I don't think the USC marching band played on this.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. Yeah, for producing the song Don't Stop for Rumors.
Right. Well, that was just everyday song. I didn't like the way it was because it was the drums started, you know, and then, but it was just a shuffle, you know, the bumped down, stop, thinking about tomorrow. And it was a shuffle song. I think it took us like 2 hours to record. It's one of the things that was, that the band did really good. Mick and Chris and John loved shuffles. And they said, and so for them, it was, we're going to play this thing. And we had everything mic'd. So once we set up in the recording studio, we set up all the instruments and mic'd them. We had them all tuned to the right frequency so we could jump on any song and get going on it right away. So that was just kind of came in just the course of doing business. And let's do the song. And they had to figure out, is it Christine going to sing the whole thing or is it going to be a kind of a duo?
Which right. is,
and the duo was the way. And then, like Fleetwood Mac always did, they always come up with these big finishes, you know, and all of a sudden they're singing the chorus in the tag. Mm-hmm. And then the chorus morphs into some sort of a, you know, don't stop thinking about tomorrow, right? Don't stop thinking about tomorrow. Oh, wait, is that what, that's not Don't Stop? Maybe that's not Don't Stop.
Yeah, it'll soon be here.
Right. By the end, so the gigantic chant chorus at the end always makes it, and then Lindsay would come in and do his guitar solo, you know, John doing the bass. And then the band was like, I thought after I did the record, I thought, this is easy. I could do it again. And I worked for somebody in a band that was had no talent, except they had good songs. And I thought, I'll just make this, just do the same thing I did on Rumors, and it should be easy. But I found out they didn't have a Lindsey Buckingham to play the guitars like that. And
right.
It's Richard Dash that said, one of the arts of knowing how to produce, knowing being a good producer is knowing who to produce. And so, because I never had those quality of musicians, especially Lindsey. I mean, the way he plays guitar, and you know, along with Chris and John and the Mick of the drums, it's crazy.
Yeah, truly. This might be kind of a silly question, Ken, and if you want to tease me after I ask it, feel free. But I'm curious if there were any songs in the album that you just had a feeling were going to be successful as you were producing them.
I mean, Silver Springs, probably, Go Your Own Way, and The Chain. But see, all those things, when Lindsey first played Go Your Own Way, he picked up acoustic guitar, and Mick was on the drums. Everybody was on their respective instruments. And Mick started playing, Lindsey started playing the acoustic guitar. And he was just going, din, 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 din. I thought he was going to break the strings or the guitar. And he was just screaming, you know, you can die your own way. And his neck was, veins were popping out. And it was like, wow, this is a weird sound. And the acoustic guitar, he was trying to play all the parts on the acoustic guitar. And it was just, I didn't think it was going to be good at all. And then as the months went on, we started doing more parts. We did the solo. And it's like, wow, this is a great song. Or the same thing with The Chain. The Chain used to be called Keep Me There. And it was kind of not a great song by Christine McVie, but they had, in the middle of The Chain, John went to that boom, 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 boom. And then Lindsey started doing the solo. So that was part of the original Keep Me There, with this amazing bass and a guitar solo that was screaming for 3 minutes. So, but we kept Keep Me There on the roster. We kept trying to pull it back. We could never figure out how to save it. And until the last month, Lindsey came in one day and he says, I have an idea. Let's re-record the verses and the choruses. And so he had me put up some clean tape in the verse section to match the length. And he had Mick play kick drum, you know, dong, to ding, and Lindsey played dobro. So it was ding, 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 dong, dong, da, 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 da. So I'm kind of taking the long way around answering your question.
No.
Because all these songs changed so dramatically from the start. And suddenly The Chain came after we put that kick drum on. And I remember the engineer at the studio, he said, Ken, you know, he whispers in my ear, Ken, the kick drum mic is collapsing. The capsule's collapsing on your kick drum mic. Looked at him and I said, sounds great, doesn't it? No. He's like, technically, okay, yeah, okay, it's collapsing, but whatever that's called, that makes a hit record. So we made the record of The Chain Was a Killer. The song, let me answer your question another way. The song that I knew was going to be the best one was You Make Love and Fun. That was just, I mean, it just, you know, four hi-hat beats, boom, the whole, all the drum kit, everything's going at the same time. And it was like, hold on, your, it's like that commercial, the guy sitting in front of speakers, you know, his air.
Oh, yeah.
And that was the song that I knew was the best. And Dreams are really good, too.
Huh. Very cool, Ken. Yeah.
Anyway, I'll let you catch up.
No problem, Ken. I appreciate it.
It wasn't silly. I didn't. There's no laughing at all.
Well, perfect. That's nice for me for a change. I'd love to know, can you take me through the experience of winning a Grammy and what that was like? It's not often I get to speak with a Grammy winner.
Well, that's, I mean, you know, it was such a weird year. And once we released the record, I guess it was released 2 months after we finished it. And we started in January 75 and we ended in January 77 or 76. No, we worked all through 76. Yeah, January 77, we finished mixing. But, and I would believe it was, the rumors came out 3 days ago, 45 years ago, on February 4th, 77. And it was an immediate hit. When Fleetwood Mac decided and told me that I was going to be labeled a producer for the record, which means you, if the record sells something, you might make, you gets a few cents here and there. But so I thought, well, yeah, right. You know, none of my other records have sold anything, you know, and I got nothing. So little did I know that I won the lotto on that, but it was funny. So, and after the record was released, I remember I was walking out of the camera store. I finally had some free time to get my camera fixed. And I got into the car and KLOS was going to play the Rumors album in its entirety. They said, the DJ, I just turned the key on. My dog was in the car and he says, now, going to play this album. It's amazing. It sounds great. Turn it up, and I want you to enjoy the whole thing. And all of a sudden, he played my album on the radio. And it's like, that I had played so many times that I'm sitting there by myself, no cell phone. I'm going to, hey, come here. It's amazing. And so that was just really a thrill, being a part of that. And so that kind of excitement. So when I went to the Grammys and I got the Grammy Award, I was sitting with the whole band, and we had heard all these accolades. It was a year later, so we had heard a lot of them. But when they called Fleetwood Mac as the producers of the year, we were also nominated for Best Engineered Album. And when that, Steely Dan got it. But anyway, so we had gotten up, Fleetwood Mac had gotten up a bunch of times for Album of the Year and different things that we won. And so when it was the finally, when it came to the producer of the year, we all stood up, and then Fleetwood Mac sat down. It was like a joke. Let's put Ken and Richard walk up to the podium by ourselves. We walk up to the podium, you know, figuring the band's right there, and look around. There's no band. And they're laughing. They're just cracking up, you know. Pick up the award for us. Anyway, so that was pretty cool.
That's awesome. That's funny. Let me see. Moving on from Fleetwood Mac then, Ken, I'd love to know, how is it that you got involved with Michael Jackson's album Bad?
After being a producer, I started investing in some businesses, and I invested in this one business that had a really unique microphone, really sensitive microphone, and Michael Jackson's camp wanted us to come use their microphone. So I actually never met Mike. I didn't even go to the session. I sent one of my people down there to work with him. So
simple as that.
Would have been fun. I probably should have gone, but I thought.
I would love to know, you mentioned it a bit earlier, Ken, what was it that prompted you to write the book, Making Rumors?
Well, I believe that Rumors was a big part of history. And I was at, and I watched the whole thing go down. And I thought, somebody's got to document this. And I was lucky enough, I'm close with the label and all their vault people. So I arranged to get all the track sheets for all the songs in my possession. So, and I went and I looked at what day I put everything on a calendar, what day I recorded the bass on the strummer or, you know, every day, every instrument. And when we started the track and when we did all the overdubs, when we did vocals. So I had a calendar laid out for the whole year, and it helped me to remember what we were doing then. So I thought, I thought, well, I just thought it was a great lesson for the world to know. I mean, the biggest thing about what excited me about this is Stevie, the band was breaking up. And I remember one day Stevie came into the room and she had just talked to her attorney. And her attorney told her that the previous album is still climbing the charts, Stevie. And so this is, it's really being a big hit. So he said, just hang in there. And if you can finish this record, you guys will be, and you can make it just as good as the other one, the last one, you will be superstars and you will never have to work again. And Stevie was always complaining that she had to be she was a cleaning lady. Lindsay would stay at home and play his guitar and she would go clean houses for people. And one of the recordings, you can hear her talking. She says, I don't want to be a cleaning lady anymore. But she said, guys, she said, just got off the phone with my attorney. And we all know we're breaking up. We all know that we're mad at each other, but let's not let it get it in the way of our record, making this record. And I just thought, so she did. And everybody put it aside. And even though the lyrics were raw and cutting and hurtful, they went ahead and they made the record. And so I thought, boy, that's determination there. That really is determination. And I wanted to write about it. I thought that needs to be told.
Now, fascinating. Is there a particular story from the book, Ken, that you might like to tease our listeners with?
Well, yeah, I guess that everybody likes the dream story. So we had Stevie, we were busy always recording, and Stevie would often didn't have anything to do. So he would try to play tambourine or something. But she talked the studio manager into letting her have access to Sly Stone's studio in the other side of the building. And he had a keyboard in there. And so she had gone in her spare time and wrote this song, Dreams. And so I just remember the door flying open on our studio. And she comes in and she goes, guys, I just wrote the best song ever. I got to play it for you. She's in. And so she goes and plays it. We always had keyboards and things in the control room. So she started playing her Dreams, her little three chords. And she's singing, you know, the line. And I'm like, and Mick grabs his drum kit, starts beating on the sofa beat. And John Levy grabbed his acoustic bass and started playing along. And Lindsay starts strumming acoustic guitar. And right before my eyes, Dreams appears. And it was just amazing. So I like to say that studio is where Dreams were made. Being right there and hearing it fresh from her mind, she did a lead vocal. Yeah, like a couple of days ago, that day she did her lead vocal. And part of it, she could never beat.
Huh.
She could never beat the lead vocal, that vocal. She could never sing it better. She was so emotional. She had so much power in her vocal. So part of that, the vocal of Dreams is the original that we tried and tried and tried to use different mics, better mics. And it was on a crappy little mic. She was just singing along with the drums. But that's a really fun story.
Yeah, that is. That's a very cool story. Thanks, Ken. So I'm curious how, in your view, the musical landscape has changed in the course of your career. How have you seen it evolve or mutate, perhaps is a better word?
Well, sadly, it's, you know, the music seems to have died, sort of. I mean, I know I just watched the Grammys the other night, and you know, that most of the musicians that perform that, I mean, music isn't made by musicians much anymore. It's made by guys working on a little laptop, and I mean, they couldn't play 20 bars and they had to. The music was, so back when the great albums were coming out with, you know, Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin and all these stories of Moody Blues, they all told stories and they were epic dramas. I mean, you listen to some of these songs, Knights in White Satin or Rumors of the Eagles, you know, their music. So we were all in the studio, we were all playing music together. And there's something that happens when musicians all play together. And like, I could turn up on an electric guitar, I could make it really bright, and everybody else would hear it in the headphones, and they go, that sounds really cool. And then somebody would react to it by doing something differently or using that sound. And then the keyboard player would do something. And then the drummer would react too, and he would beat, and he had changed his beat a little more tempo and faster tempo. I mean, it's real music made, and you don't never know where it's going to go until you listen back. And I just think that people should try recording live and see what they do. It's sometimes more expensive, but I mean, that's my simple answer. So you know, get back into the studio and try making music.
Sure.
And really.
Yeah, I would feel as you do, Ken. I'm curious, you know, for any production students that might end up listening to our discussion here, is there any advice that you would consider giving them?
I mean, besides playing live?
Yes, sir.
I don't know. I think my daughter, I learned that she, most people, I think they record a song too high of a key for them. So I have many times people come and ask me to come in the studio and they're having trouble hitting some of the notes, or, and I'll usually say, drop it down a step or two and it'll take the key down a little bit. So instead of your voice is up here and like that, it drops down here and it relaxes bigger and more full. So that's however you say that, you know, try singing in a lower key and see how your voice sounds.
Interesting. Just a few questions left here, Ken, then you're no longer my prisoner, okay? Over the course of your career, I'm curious, is there a particular accomplishment that you're especially proud of?
Oh, my daughter?
There you go. That's what I was thinking you were going to say.
Yeah, and my daughter was my greatest production. But I mean, seeing her transform it from a little girl into a singer was really, really rewarding. The best thing I ever told her, and she said this on camera to before I was, so Colby used to sing all the time around the house. Her older sister would like to sleep in, but Colby liked to get up 6 a.m. and she walk around the house singing, and sometimes she would, you know, push her voice, and so we can give her guitar, gave her music lessons, voice lessons, to make sure she was using her voice properly and not damaging it and breathing properly. And then I was driving home one day from the studio, and I was thinking about Colby, and I said, wait a minute, she's got a great voice, but what's she going to sing? What's she going to sing? Are we going to have to, if I don't do something, we're going to have to buy songs from, you know, or do covers of somebody else's songs. And I said, you know, and I know that you can't buy a song from a big writer. You can't buy a hit song if you're unknown. So I said, Colby, you're going to need to write your own songs. Learn to write your own songs. I said, if you learn to write your own songs, you'll be able to, you will have control of everything. And I said, I promise you, the moment you put your hands on an instrument, your heart will reach it through your voice and you will make magic. So she took guitar lessons. She wrote her first song on the first day of her guitar lessons. And she never stopped writing a song. And when you write that many songs, she's got, I don't know, 300 songs or something. That's a catalog. And now she makes big money and she's in control of her career. And so, I mean, I tell everybody that I know that says they have a son or daughter that sings a lot to get a music lesson, get them to put their hands on the instruments and sing, open their mouth. That, you know, that was one of the best things that ever happened.
Wow. That's incredible, Ken. I'm happy for you and her. That's great.
Yeah. I'm recording Christine McVie and her Songbird. That was an amazing recording. But we can talk about that.
Let me see. No, feel free. I'd love to hear that story if you're up to sharing.
Sure. I mean, that's in the book also. So Making Rumors of the book. So it's kind of a silly story. That it was the end of the night. I remember we were in the studio and I was rolling up cables, cleaning up for that night. So be ready for the next morning, because we were probably later than I wanted to be there. And Christine sits down on the piano and starts playing this song. And it was like, oh my God. And it was so, so beautiful and so haunting. I laugh at myself. I go over there. I sit down on a piano bench next to her. That's really a no-no. She looks over at me. She's playing like, what are you doing? She didn't say that. She just kept playing. But I thought, then I realized my time is probably better spent someplace else. So I ran into the control room and hit record on the tape recorder, because all the instruments were always mic'd up. I got the rest of a song on tape. But so the piano was like really dry and just like in your face, ding, 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 for you. Dee, 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 dee. So we listened to it the next morning and she was, then Ken played the song I did last night. She says this, and she plays it for everybody and said, I just wrote this. It's amazing. And I said, yeah, but you know, Chris, I said, something wrong with the piano. I said, I had just recorded Joni Mitchell live at a place called the Berklee Community Theater. And I had it was an audience, and it was a live performance, and it was an ambient show. The piano was ringing out through the hall. And I said, we just had recorded Joni. I said, the piano sounded amazing. I said, we should do that. We should go to Berklee Community Theater and record this piano, their piano there for this song. And the band said, okay. I'm like, what? Okay. Yeah. Go ahead and make it happen, Ken. Okay. So I called around and got the hall. Berklee Community Theater wasn't available, but we used Zellerbach, which is a concert hall. And so I brought all these mics in, and I was going to get every nuance of piano that floated around the hall anywhere it was. And I did. And it was an amazing recording. But we worked, I think, from noon till 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning. I didn't realize that when I got in there that the piano wasn't loud enough to make the hall resonance. So we actually had to put it run it to the PA system. Same with her vocal. It wasn't loud enough to make the hall resonate, so we had to run it through a PA system. So we weren't prepared for that, and we had to figure out how to get all that going because there was no PA system there. But anyway, we figured out, we overcame every obstacle and made this amazing recording that is amazing. And I told Colby, she's got a new piano song, and I said, we should do the same thing, go to a concert hall and get a really live ambient sound in her piano. But sometimes, you know, little things like that can make the big deal. It's just the record. The song would have never been the same if it was done in a studio.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah, the little things that are really the big things, right? Ken, I'd love to know, what is Artist Max?
Artist Max is my artist development company. So when Colby started, when she started writing songs, she wrote a song called Bubbly. And Bubbly went right through the ceiling. It went that her friend had posted her song on MySpace. And MySpace was if you remember it, everybody could take somebody's song and they could put it on their page. So when you went to Joe Blow's page, they could have Colby playing on it. So it was kind of a sharing music platform. But next thing I know, she did all this stuff, but kind of without me knowing. And she says, hey, Dad, I'm getting calls from attorneys who want me to sign with them. And it kind of forced me to rethink everything. But anyway, so she was, I'm trying, what was the question?
Oh, just what was Artist Max?
Oh, yeah, Artist Max. Thanks, you.
No problem.
Anyway, so what happened when Colby, she got a sign right away with a record deal. They sent her out on the road to open for the Goo Goo Dolls. And she's just like this kid. She had no experience to play, you know, live, and she didn't know. And people would say, we love you, Colby. And she goes, thank you. I used to say, don't say thank you. Say thank you and, you know, thank you, Chicago. I love this town. It's, you know, how many of you from here? And get the audience involved, right? It's because being a singer is one thing, but you're actually an entertainer. Mm-hmm. Get to learn how to entertain. So what Artist Max is, teaches an artist how to entertain, how to be a showman. So, and what I found is that with Colby, we had to send her on the road with this choreographer who was teach her how to sing, how to move, and how to stand, and how to not look silly. And it took Colby about a year of this person on the road the whole time. And the lady would talk in Colby's ear, and they say something, and she'd say, I love you too. And Colby could hear it. And then she started learning the pacing of what be an entertainer. So I started thinking that, so that's expensive to do, but everyone should have that access to talent like that to teach you choreography, teach you vocal lessons, teach you how to breathe, how to dress, you know, how to eat, how to stay healthy while you're on the road, you know, so Artist Max does all that. And so we have choreographers come in and they teach you how to own the stage and strut your stuff walking across the stage. I remember we had this lady one time and want to teach you how to walk across the stage in your high heels. Well, how hard can that be? She goes, try it, you know. Try it, don't try not to fall off the stage, you know, while I'm walking. You know, there's a thing, and it's not natural. It doesn't come natural to everybody. The Artist Max is just giving people that edge. And you get vocal lessons, you get songwriting training, you get choreographer, you learn how to dress on a student's budget like a rock star, and how to eat healthy, you know. So we give the upcoming artists the tools they need to do the job right. And I feel that it's chops off 3 or 4 years of their growth process. Sometimes you're 23 and you're starting to do this and you're learning, and then 24, 25, 26, you're still perfecting it. You're still doing it. Next thing you know, you're 27 or 28. Whereas if you have these lessons at 23, you could be out the door and on the road. So that's what we do. We have Artist Max events. We're having one coming up, I think, this May, end of April, 1st of May.
Ken Clay, how can people find out about you, sir?
You can go to, I think I have a website. You can go to Artist Max. You can go to kenkelly.com. I think I still have something there. You can buy the book, Making Rumors. And that's, you'll be sitting on my shoulder for 1 year of recording. And people call me and tell me that's a, you know, it's a very meaningful book.
Excellent. Ken, this was such a pleasure. I really appreciate you taking the time for me. Thank you.
Well, you made the time pass quickly and be warm, my friend.
You too, sir. You take care.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. We can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.